KSDP, 830 AM in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Juneau, Alaska School District is expanding its support of a local language immersion program. After multiple meetings and extended debate, the school board has agreed to fund more of the Tlingit Language Immersion Program in the upcoming school year, even amid statewide school budgeting concerns. KTOO's Yvonne Krumrie reports.
The program in question is Atkuaha, Expanding the Tlingit Culture, Language, and Literacy Program, or TCLL. The school district and the nonprofit arm of a regional Native corporation have historically roughly split the cost. The school board signed a memorandum of agreement Wednesday with the Alaska Heritage Institute to increase its investment in the project. But school board members brought up questions about whether the district should pay for more of the TCLL program amidst widespread concerns about funding. Board member Elizabeth Sidden said the school supports TCLL, but they have to balance that with the needs of the entire district.
But we support it amongst how we support all of our 4,000 students. So I'm trying to keep in mind that these 119 are not the only students we're responsible for.
The school board initially approved the change during its budget process. They were then under the impression that the grant SHI used for the program was ending, according to the school board president. But SHI was later approved for an extension of the grant. The program isn't growing, but now the school district will fund 8 of its 11 positions. And the change requires additional funding from the school district's budget. SHI Education Director Christy Ford said the program is intended to increase the number of Tlingit language speakers.
We have less than 10 fluent speakers left, so the need and the urgency to put intensive amount of support and instruction into the TCLL program was asked of us.
In recent meetings, some school board members said the program only serves a small percentage of Juneau students. But Ford said the scope is intentional. It's intense and immersive, so that there's a group of dedicated speakers to make sure the Tlingit language doesn't go extinct. In Juneau, I'm Yvonne Krumrie.
Montana's Native families face higher rates of separation with a disproportionate number of Native kids in foster care. A nonprofit in Lodgegrass is developing a center aimed at keeping tribal families together and out of social services. Montana Public Radio's Victoria Trexler has more.
Mountain Shadow Association recently began construction of a family healing center to support communities on the Crow Reservation. Executive Director Megan Doyle explains addiction and behavioral health issues can break apart families. She says children from the reservation are often sent to foster care families out of state when these issues arise. The center, called Kala's Village, aims to change that.
That's what Kala's Village is really trying to do, is provide this consistent and constant relationship and connection, and to help repair those places where connection and relationship are broken.
The center's approach is based in restorative justice, which aims to address the root cause of crimes instead of incarceration. Doyle says they hope to break cycles of abuse and trauma. Kala's Village was developed from years of direct dialogue between the nonprofit and Lodgegrass community members.
They really wanted it to be a safe place for them and for their children. And they also wanted to make sure that they were going to be surrounded by people who shared similar goals with them in recovery. So
the 13-acre campus will have housing along with a preschool and caretakers to help supervise the children. Doyle says they hope to fully open by the end of 2026. In Missoula, I'm Victoria Traxler.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by Drummond Woodsum, a full-service law firm whose nationally recognized tribal nations practice provides services to tribal nations and their enterprises and to companies that do business with tribes across the country.
More at dwmlaw.com. DT Track, your healthcare partner across Indian country, supports this show. DT Track provides culturally competent nationwide healthcare staffing to IHS, tribal, and urban health facilities. More at dt-track.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
To go from camping in the woods into something more stable and not just displaced and create a more unstable situation.
Anchorage officials hope to move residents of the city's two largest homeless camps into shelter. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, May 30th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Matsu Library board members will review hundreds of books a month, duplicating the work of librarians.
Adding a step to look at it where somebody repeats all of that sort of analysis just seems incredibly inefficient.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Matson, delivering the essentials for everyday life in the last frontier. Learn more at matson.com/Alaska.
IBEW's path to success includes excellent training, good wages, benefits, and a comfortable retirement. Join the IBEW and build a bright future. Call 907-575-7285 to find out more. This message sponsored by IBEW Local 1547.
Anchorage police and municipal workers are set to clear the city's two largest homeless camps next month. Notices went up today in Mountain View's Davis Park and the nearby snow dump. Alaska Public Media's Hannah Floor reports.
The mayor's office says the two camps have negatively affected the surrounding neighborhood for years, reducing residents' access to public spaces and increasing risk for the nearby military base. The office says it's also an unsafe environment for people living in the camps. Farina Brown is Mayor Suzanne LaFrance's special assistant on homelessness and health. She says there's a bunch of extra federal money that makes the timing right.
So we have about $5.1 million of emergency rental assistance that will be flowing through the system that will help move individuals that are experiencing homelessness into housing.
Brown says the plan is to prioritize rental assistance for people already in the city's shelter system. She says that'll open up shelter beds for the roughly 100 people living in the Mountain View camps. But it's not just about pushing people out of the camps and into shelter. Brown says the city is also focusing on outreach that includes connecting campers to long-term housing and rehabilitation.
We have seen a lot of individuals that are very interested in exiting the camps. What is critical for us is ensuring that we can move them as couples, as cohorts.
Brown says that's a priority because people are more open to outreach when they keep their social safety net intact. And she says there's already been a lot of human-to-human contact.
We often forget that in any human interaction, trust is going to be paramount. And what we see, the level of engagement that has been received from the campers in Davis Park, is a reflection of the work that's happened well in advance of where we are right now.
Phil Cannon is president of the Mountain View Community Council. He says the mayor's office has been working closely with the council.
We've asked them to do it slowly and carefully and methodically so that it could be done in the most compassionate way possible. You know, to go from camping in the woods into something more stable and not just displaced and create a more unstable situation.
He says he feels like the mayor's office has listened to their requests.
This could have been a lot worse for a lot of people. You know, the city could have just come in and put up 10-day notices and not done any of the extra outreach.
The city plans to begin clearing the camps at Davis Park and the snow dump on June 17th. Once the police department's community action policing team has made sure that all campers have left, the plan is for the city's Healthy Spaces team to begin cleanup. The mayor's office estimates that it'll take several weeks to complete the work. Brown says some people likely will try to relocate within the same area. She says that's something the Anchorage Police Department is expected to address.
We're absolutely working with APD to ensure that they are able to quickly respond to any re-encampments that we're seeing so that the community knows that we want to address their concerns.
The mayor's office says it plans to post no camping signs and continue to work with police to enforce trespassing laws. And the police department plans to increase patrols in and around Mountain View to make sure new camps don't pop up. In Anchorage, I'm Hannah Floor.
The Matanuska Susitna Borough introduced a new library policy earlier this month that would have an advisory board review new materials for the borough's five public libraries. KTNA's Andrew Gelderman reports.
The policy would have the library board review all new purchased library materials for the Matsu Borough's public libraries. Currently, librarians have an internal review process following the borough's collection and development policy, purchasing books based on community want and need. Borough Community Development Director Jillian Morrissey introduced the new policy at a library board meeting earlier this month. She said the new procedure is meant to promote transparency and claimed it's becoming more commonplace for advisory committees to provide input on the collection process for public libraries. The policy will go into effect in August, according to Morrissey, but few details were available at the meeting. However, other library officials say the change is unusual. David Cox is the chair of the Alaska Libraries Association's Collection Development Roundtable, which aims to improve library resources for Alaskan libraries. He says advisory boards aren't typically involved with the individual materials during the collection process.
A lot of these advisory boards, they're looking at big picture, they're looking at vision, but getting into that nitty-gritty daily sort of activity is the sort of thing that a board hires staff to do.
He adds that librarians already follow a collection plan when reviewing new materials, and doubling those efforts through another separate board would take up time and money.
If you're already employing someone to be really like diving in and doing some of this process of looking for and selecting based on your community's already existing collection development policy, adding a step to look at it where somebody repeats all of that sort of analysis just seems incredibly inefficient.
The borough's five libraries add anywhere from 400 to 600 new materials to their collections throughout a given month, according to local librarians. Considering the library board only meets 9 months out of the year, library board member Mary Fisher voiced her concerns about providing thoughtful analysis on so many materials.
To review 400 to 600 books a month without time to read them or to review their content, you would have us judge a book by its cover.
Since the meeting in early May, the borough has declined to provide more information on any specifics of the new policy. In Talkeetna, I'm Andrew Gelderman.
Sitka voters have overwhelmingly rejected a ballot measure that would have capped the number of cruise visitors beginning next year. KCAW's Catherine Rose reports.
Wednesday's special election brought out almost 3,000 voters, 73% of whom rejected the proposition. This was the third largest turnout for any municipal election in Sitka since 2018. Sitka Sound Cruise Terminal owner Chris McGraw led the opposition to the proposition. His group, called Safeguard Sitka's Future, organized early in the process and even campaigned to discourage residents from signing the petition initiative. McGraw was heartened by the night's results.
I think it, you know, shows that the community understands the benefits of cruise tourism and that the proposed ballot initiative wasn't the right answer at this time.
Although the outcome was a decisive no, McGraw is aware that the industry has work to do to address the concerns of the 27% of voters who supported limiting cruise visits to Sitka, like acquiring better buses and refining the terms of a Memorandum of Understanding, or MOU, with City Hall to make sure the 7,000 passenger per day cap called for in that document is met.
But I think that's all a conversation that you have with the Tourism Commission and the public, and everybody weighs in so that we don't jeopardize the economic impact but still maintain what makes Sitka a great place to live.
Although it was not a good night for the proposition's supporters, one of its authors, Larry Edwards, was glad to have had a chance to put the issue before voters, a process which took him 2 years and 4 attempts. Edwards said voters were faced with a very narrow choice on a complicated issue, and he does not consider the outcome an endorsement of the cruise terminal's MOU with the city.
So there's still the question of what numbers does the town really want, and would the town accept the regulatory approach, or does it really like the MOU approach, which is voluntary and really not that enforceable?
Initiative co-sponsor Claudia Lassesse was unhappy in the outcome, but hopeful that Sitkins had a better understanding of the issue.
It's, of course, like you said, a disappointment. But on the other hand, the people got a chance to vote, and I think that's really critical. And hopefully things will work out in the way that's best for Sitka over the course of time.
The final tally on Sitka's special election to limit cruise ships was 773 in favor and 2,071 opposed. Well over half of the electorate chose to cast their ballots early in this election. 121 absentee ballots will be counted on June 2nd, but they will not affect the outcome. The Sitka Assembly will certify the results at its first regular meeting in June. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Catherine Rose.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the U.S. side of the historic Chilkoot Trail will reopen for the first time in 5 years.
It's called sometimes the world's longest museum. There's all sorts of artifacts that you can see and signs from the past.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Construction season is here, Alaska. Go to dot.alaska.gov/construction to learn about road, airport, and facilities projects across the state. You can zoom in on projects in your community using the interactive map, view traffic impacts, download data, and look at construction photos that will update all season long. Visit dot.alaska.gov/construction to learn more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities.
An Alaska state trooper rescued a Fairbanks man early Thursday who'd fallen into the icy waters of the Tanana River north of Nenana. Troopers say they got a 911 call at around 2:30 a.m. about a man who'd fallen into the Tanana calling for help. Trooper Nathan Hollenbach responded to the call and located the man about 15 feet below the ledge of the steel dock. A trooper dispatch identified the man as 37-year-old Jonathan Pitka of Fairbanks. The dispatch says Hollenbach tried to pull Pitka out of the water with a tow strap connected to his patrol vehicle, but the man was so hypothermic that he couldn't hold onto the strap. So Hollenbach stripped off his duty gear and fashioned a harness using rescue climbing rope and rappelled down into the water to hold on to Pitka. The trooper remained in the water while holding on to Pitka for about 30 minutes until Nenana EMS medics and a Nenana resident got a boat on scene to get both rescuer and victim out of the water. Medics transported both to Fairbanks Memorial Hospital for treatment of hypothermia. After he warmed up and was evaluated by medical staff, Hollenbeck was discharged and released. A hospital nursing supervisor said Thursday afternoon that Pitka was admitted to the hospital and was in critical condition. Air quality in Fairbanks, somewhat infamously, has at times been among the worst in the nation. But efforts to clear the air and lose that reputation are paying off. Levels of a specific air pollutant, known as PM2.5, are down by about half over the past decade, according to the Environmental Protection Agency. With particles no bigger than 2.5 micrometers in diameter, PM2.5 is just right for embedding in people's lungs. It mainly comes from burning wood, an important heat source in Fairbanks. Alaska Beacon reporter Yareth Rosen recently wrote about how, despite a combination of cold air and geography that traps pollution, Fairbanks is seeing its air quality improve thanks in large part to drying out birch firewood before burning it.
Birch has a lot of moisture in it, like a lot more than spruce. And so when people are, they have a bunch of birch logs and they're putting them into their wood stove without drying them, they're not going to burn efficiently. They're going to produce a lot more smoke and a lot more particulates. So drying the birch, this is an important part of the big plan called a SIP, or a state implementation plan. There's a lot of bureaucratic stuff in this, but anyway, this is an important part. Like, have kiln-dried birch available, kiln-dried wood available. If you go to the kiln, which I did, and you stand outside, you just see all the steam coming up, and that's just all the steam coming out of the wood.
Yeah. So that, along with the stove buyback program, they had money to pay people for their old stoves to get them more efficient new stoves, brings us to the fun part, which is that the air quality is dramatically better now in Fairbanks, right? I mean, that's
right, yeah.
Kind of the upshot
yeah.
here.
Yeah. If you look at the air quality, there's all these air quality measurements, you know, these measuring stations. And the way the EPA puts it is that the days when there are when there are violations, it's at a level that is only about half as high as it used to be. And there just aren't that many 24-hour violations, but there's still some.
Yeah. Well, I imagine, like, the local leaders in Fairbanks, Borough Mayor Grier Hopkins, might, you know, be applauding this and, you know, not exactly declaring victory, but definitely happy about this. But, I mean, there are still days that are in violation. What's the, I guess, the long-term picture here? I mean, do they get out of this situation where they're, like, constantly being monitored by the EPA or what?
Well, it doesn't look like that's going to happen anytime soon, that they'll get out of the situation. Mm. And if you kind of look at other cities that have inversions and air pollution problems, they sort of never get out of the situation where they have to worry. They always are going to have to worry about it. The very long-term solution would be, you know, some kind of energy that doesn't make smoke, which would be like an alternative energy, you know, renewable energy, and which is all this is why, partly why the Fairbanks situation is of interest to people who are outside of Fairbanks and outside of Alaska and outside of the United States even, because it's a really interesting case study. You know, the mayor and other people in Fairbanks, they kind of get it, irritated at the idea that Fairbanks has this bad reputation. They don't like having the bad reputation for having bad air. Mm-hmm. So it's important for them to show the progress. And, you know, they do deserve credit for making progress, even though people got mad and didn't want to have the borough do any enforcement. So now the borough is just like in a position of, you know, they're trying to encourage people to do things and show the benefits.
Yeah.
And so it's more like a carrot than a stick.
Yeah, I feel like that's what this turned into.
Yeah.
And I guess this is the part where I have to admit publicly that I'm from Fairbanks. And
yeah.
I remember being there when, you know, there were many, many, many meetings about this at the borough level. And I distinctly remember one man testifying in public testimony that if a borough inspector tried to come up on his roof, he'd shoot him off like a squirrel, you know. So I guess that all makes me wonder, you know, with this news that, you know, the number of days per year that they're, you know, in violation is half as much as it used to be. Is it any less controversial than it was?
Well, there's some things in the plan that are still bothering people. There's some things that homeowners have to do. But I think that just the fact that there is progress and that it's like not a hopeless thing is probably making people a little less upset about it. And you know, people don't want to breathe dirty air as well. You know, there's plenty of people who are taking it seriously, plenty of residents. They don't want the kids breathing fine particulates.
That was Alaska Beacon reporter Yareth Rosen. Find her full story about how Fairbanks' air quality has improved over the past decade at alaskabeacon.com. Aircraft maintenance crews from Alaska and South Korea have repaired a U.S. Air Force F-16 fighter jet that made an emergency landing last week on a remote island in the Bering Sea. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, the jet flew out of St. Paul Island on Thursday en route to Eielson Air Force Base.
The South Korea-based F-16 was headed to Alaska on May 19th to participate in an upcoming training exercise when an engine problem occurred. The pilot declared an in-flight emergency and landed at the St. Paul Island Airport. The F-16's assigned to the 8th Fighter Wing out of Kunsan Air Base in the Republic of Korea. A Kunsan spokesperson said maintenance crews from Eielson and Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson joined up with a crew from Kunsan and repaired the jet earlier this week, but it couldn't fly out because the island was socked in by bad weather. An Eielson spokesperson said Thursday the repaired F-16 and another that flew along with it were both on their way to Eielson for the training exercise. The Kunsan spokesperson said the maintenance personnel who fixed the plane determined that the aircraft's engine ran low on oil. The spokesperson added that 8th Operations Group Deputy Commander Lieutenant Colonel James Devine thanked the residents of St. Paul Island for their hospitality and support while the jets and their pilots were awaiting repairs. For KUAC News, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips Alaska, building the next generation of Alaska's workforce through investments in education and vocational training. ConocoPhillips Alaska, committed to Alaska for more than 50 years. If domestic violence has touched your life, know that you are not alone. You have the power to break free and build a future filled with love and respect. There's hope and help waiting for you. For free and confidential support, visit notaloneak.org to speak to someone who's trained to help. Every Alaskan deserves to feel safe. This message sponsored by the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
Alaska volcano researchers say seismic activity around Mount Spur has continued to decline over the last month, but the closest active volcano to the state's population centers could still erupt. In March, officials with the Alaska Volcano Observatory noted an increase in gas emissions at Spur, about 80 miles west of Anchorage. At the time, they said an eruption was likely to occur within weeks or months. However, in mid-April, volcanic activity at Spur started to decrease. Volcanic geologist Christy Wallace says that downward trend in activity has continued.
We think that that magma has stalled, so it just isn't moving, meaning we're not seeing earthquakes that reflect movement, and we're not seeing any deformation, so that pause continues.
Wallace emphasizes that the volcano is still at a yellow alert level, indicating that volcanic activity at Spur is well above normal and an eruption is still possible. She says current activity at Spur is similar to 2004 and 2005, when it reached yellow level but ultimately did not erupt. She says there's one important distinction with how this event unfolded.
The big difference is that we saw a lot of earthquakes right under Crater Peak, and that's what got us really concerned, and that's why there was a lot of preparedness in the community across South Central Alaska, is because that type of activity resulted in an eruption in 1992, and we didn't want to be short-sighted and not let our community know about that.
Wallace says signs of a pending eruption would include an increase in gas emissions, deformation of the peak, and a rise in shallow earthquakes near the volcano. You can monitor updates to Mount Spur's activity at avo.alaska.edu. The U.S. portion of a historic 33-mile hiking trail between Skagway and British Columbia has been off-limits to backcountry explorers since 2020. But that is about to change, with one key caveat. The Alaska Desk's Avery Elfelt reports.
The National Park Service said Wednesday that the U.S. segment of the Chilkoot National Historic Trail will be open in June for the first time in years.
And the entire section of the trail is going to be open once again to hikers, and we're very excited.
That's Angela Witz, the superintendent of the Klondike Gold Rush National Historic Park. About half of the trail is on the U.S. side of the border. Much of that has been closed since 2020 due to the pandemic and flood damage. The National Park Service eventually opened up the first several miles of the U.S. trail after preliminary repairs, but the rest has remained closed until now. That means hikers will be able to hike to the Canadian border from Dyea, a Gold Rush ghost town near Skagway. What remains uncertain, Witz says, is whether they'll be able to cross the border and continue on until they reach Bennett City in British Columbia.
Canadian Border Services Agency is currently reviewing a proposal developed by Parks Canada and the National Park Service to determine if visitors could meet their reporting obligations for entry into Canada through the trail.
For now, that means the trail is open from Skagway to the border, but not beyond that. U.S. Customs and Border Patrol, for its part, has decided hikers won't be allowed to enter the U.S. from the Canadian side of the trail because it's not a port of entry. That's a shift from how things worked before the closure, but Wetz emphasized that the vast majority of hikers start in Skagway and end in Canada. The trail itself carries significant meaning in the region, and as a result was designated a National Historic Trail several years ago.
It's called sometimes the world's longest museum. There's all sorts of artifacts that you can see and signs from the past of the uses on that trail.
For millennia, the trail served as a trade route for the Tlingit people between the Inside Passage and the headwaters of the Yukon River. But in the 1880s, prospectors and miners started using the trail themselves, which later became a major transportation route to the Yukon goldfields, Eventually, it was replaced by the White Pass and Yukon Route Railway. In Haines, I'm Avery Elfelt.
A team of about 10 people just returned from visiting the old shipwreck site of the Star of Bengal near Wrangell. They mapped and surveyed the site, hoping to get more information on the shipwreck that killed over 100 cannery workers. KSDK's Colette Zarnicki has this story.
The shipwreck is about 80 miles west of Wrangell, close to Coronation Island. Local fisherman Gig Decker first dove at the site in the 90s. He's a member of UCHART, or the Underwater Cultural Heritage Archaeological Research Team, which has been investigating the site for a few years now. Decker says the team had a goal in mind for this last dive, to recover the ship's bell. He says a biologist found the bell at the site a few years ago and they wanted to recover it for conservation purposes.
For shipwreck enthusiasts, the bell is as important as the anchor. It's a very important part of it.
The Star of Bengal sank almost 120 years ago. The vessel was heading from Wrangell back to San Francisco when it wrecked during a storm. The UCHART team shipped the vessel's bell to Texas A&M Conservation Lab with the intention to preserve it at the Wrangell Museum in the future. The group wrote about the bell on their Facebook page. It says, quote, "Watching it breaking the surface after 117 years underwater was an emotional moment. Once the conservation is completed, we will hear the voice of the ship again," end quote. Decker says they also located other artifacts, the debris pile, the anchor, and the chain. But there's something else that's more pressing on his mind.
The thing that we're more interested in than anything is the fact that the majority of the Asians that died on the wreck were locked in the forward hold. And of course, there's been a lot of testimony both ways about whether they were locked down or not.
Researchers found that over 100 cannery workers, mostly Chinese, Japanese, and Filipino, perished in the boat, while roughly 30, mostly white, crew members survived. Decker says he hopes an underwater forensic investigation leads to some answers. Decker says UCHART is a sister organization to the Wrangell Mariners Memorial, which honors people who've died at sea. He's also a board member of Friends of the Museum, which will eventually help rehome the bell at the museum.
I think it's really important to recognize the fact that we're all in kind of the same game, is that we're trying to preserve the memory of the history of Wrangell. And the significance to our community.
Decker says that Wrangell's history goes back hundreds of years, and the stories that UCHART is uncovering at sea will help enrich the local museum. In Wrangell, I'm Colette Zarnicki.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Hannah Floor and Wesley Early in Anchorage, Andrew Gelderman in Talkeetna, Catherine Rose in Sitka, Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, Avery Elfelt in Haines, and Colette Zarnicki in Wrangell. Our audio engineer tonight is Chris Hyde. Tim Rocky's our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Princess Lodges, offering glass-domed railcar tours to Talkeetna and Denali National Park for Alaska summer adventures. Your journey begins at princesslodges.com. Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, marking 47 years of commitment to operating the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
Public media is about you, the community we serve. Thank you for tuning in. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media. Let me tell you about the way she loved me. Who want the world to know? I'm crazy about the way she loved me. Oh, proud to let it show. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Morning Show. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So in the meantime, you'll be resting on my mind. For the last time, I will leave myself behind. In the evenings, raise a glass and tell some lies. Make a pass, impress another girl. She's easy on the eyes. She was easy, so was I. My reflection in the window when I ride for Chicago. She is on the other side. Take a picture. Write a letter to my love. Well, I was almost honest. I was almost honest. I lay with you in bed. Conversations full of words you never said. I got your message, but I didn't hear the ringing bell. I gave in to the loneliness, but I didn't give up nothing else. Which direction? I was almost honest. In the window when I ride, could not save us, but I swear to God I tried. Take a picture, write a letter to my love. I was almost honest. Well, I was almost.
On the run, looking out for number one. I took a ride to the city, had to get out of this place. I just can't stand the pity when the tears fall down my face. I used to think it was over, but it's only just begun. Now I'm living on the run, looking out for number for number one. Day you'll see me, but only when you're dreaming. One day you'll say I was the one. Late at night, start to fight. I just might think about him. Right now I'm feeling fine.
dreams are just dreams when they're stuck inside your head. And all it takes is a little help from you. You know it's true that dreams are for real when you see what I see and you feel it too. We took the longest road just to make it harder.
Much to see in this fall. dancing. This little song is about second chances. Just say the word and I will rejoice and wake up to the sound of your voice. Oh, I miss waking up to the sound. Not much to see in this void. Sometimes you're worthless and we get low. We will grow.
you're feeling lost in the night, when you feel your world just ain't right, call on me and we'll be waiting. Count on me and we'll be there. Anytime the times get too tough, anytime you're there.